Get ready for the worst legal ethics in the history of cinema. It's mid-80s hit Jagged Edge, and it was the number one movie in America.
The number one movie in America.
Number one.
The number one movie in America.
Whoa, number one.
The number one movie in America.
Number one.
The number one movie in America.
Oh, whoa, number one.
The number one movie in America.
Movie in America. Number one.
The number one movie in America.
Number one.
The number one movie in America.
Number one.
The number one movie in America.
Movie in America.
This is the number one movie in America, and we don't like have an entire CIA analyst bullpen worth of people today.
We're rogue agents.
We have me and Robin and like about half of Robin.
Yes, I had laryngitis this weekend. I am still recovering my voice. I hope this is not painful to listen to.
No.
Yeah.
It
okay.
just sounds it's lean into it and, right. and get like a Marianne Faithfull thing going.
Okay. Or Kathleen Turner.
Yeah, exactly. Camila could not be with us today. Aaron had a last minute emergency plumbing situation, which, you know, you don't just leave the house if there's water coming out of a thing.
You don't.
That it's not supposed to come out of. Usually we want to do these with three or four of us, but given the circumstances, we are pressing on because between the two of us, I know we have a lot to say about Jagged Edge.
So one thing I want to say, getting straight off the bat, is that I know we have a few fans who watch along with us.
Right.
And I think that this is a movie that if you are interested in, you should definitely watch it before listening because it lives and dies on the whodunit element. So the twists and turns, we're going to spoil everything. So go watch the movie and then come back.
Oh, I'm going to spoil it literally immediately.
That's why I started out with, hey,
right.
go watch the movie first.
Because I'm up for the 60-second recap. Robin, yeah. do you have some sort of timing device?
I do.
Because I called you out for going to 63 seconds last week, and I want to be held to the same strict standard.
Okay.
Here today.
You ready?
Mm-hmm.
Go.
A socialite with the most 80s house in the history of movies is murdered in an almost unfathomably brutal opening scene. Immediately, husband Jeff Bridges gets arrested because it's always the husband. He hires phenomenally poised lawyer Glenn Close to represent him. She used to be a defense attorney but stopped doing criminal law after a thinly sketched subplot happened a few years ago. She takes the job anyway because Jeff Bridges likes horses and becomes convinced of both his innocence and his fuckability. At about the 1 hour mark, they bang. We get to the trial at which both sides rely entirely on surprise witnesses the other side didn't know about, and Glenn Close wins by pinning blame on a token douchey tennis pro. Glenn and the dude go off to begin their life together, at which point she immediately discovers it really was him. He tries to murder her, and she kills him instead. Also, Robert Loggia was there to swear a lot.
Time. Oh my gosh.
What was it?
It was 59.
Oh, I'm so proud.
Wow, that's amazing.
I didn't plan it to be so close, but I'm glad to have nailed this one.
I'm proud of you.
Thank you. 59 seconds. Where to begin? I mean, I'm going to do all of the stats and the numbers and everything, but like
I'm genuinely curious, was this a real hit? Or was it just kind of like there wasn't anything coming out this weekend?
It was a sleeper hit.
Okay.
It was a through a summer full of young skewing blockbusters,
mm-hmm.
this was the movie for grown-ups that just kind of hung around.
Okay.
Yeah. But before we, I want to get this out of the way. That opening scene, though?
You know, you had warned me about it, and so I didn't actually think it was all that terrible. I mean, like, look, it's terrible. Basically, it's like this guy breaks into the house and, you know, puts a jagged edge knife
mm-hmm.
directly over this woman's face in her headboard
yeah.
and then sexually menaces her. Do they show her actually being murdered?
I think so.
Okay.
It struck
scary.
Me as really brutal.
It's scary.
My immediate reaction was, this is the most brutal opening scene we've covered, and we had a movie that began with a boat full of refugees getting shot.
Yeah, I was more upset by that. But this, I mean, I think also I'm a little bit more desensitized to, like, home invasion murder scenes. I feel like those happen all the time.
That's true.
Whereas, like, mass murder of innocents just also wasn't what I signed up for. Whereas
right,
I knew that this movie was going to start with murder.
Yes. with jagged edged murder. Like, man,
how many times do they say jagged edge?
They say jagged edge
and
so
jag,
many times.
They also say jag a lot of times, which is funny because in Pittsburgh, that's a way to say like an asshole.
Yeah. Bunch of jags in this movie and their edges. But why is that the metaphor for what this movie is like? Because they live on the jagged edge of law?
I don't think it is a metaphor. I think it's just an interesting sounding phrase. It's like triple frontier or whatever. It's like, this vaguely sounds like what this movie is. So
they could have just
called
it Big Hunting Knife. Yeah. It is the equivalent of having called it Big Hunting Knife. Yeah. The movie.
Okay.
Okay. The beginning
let's hear the numbers.
The beginning is rough, but if you're curious, get through it. If you're curious, you should have already watched it. I just spoiled the whole thing, but we told you that. Released on October 4th, 1985, which is not when it went to number one.
Interesting.
It debuted at number two, making $4.1 million behind another debuting film, Commando. It was second behind Commando, which made $7.7 million. Incidentally, of course, Commando was ending the one-week reign of Invasion USA.
Wow.
Jagged Edge is two number ones after Invasion USA. Three straight weekends would go Commando at number one and Jagged Edge at number two. But Jagged Edge, as I said, just held better. It barely dropped at all throughout the summer, reaching number one in its fourth weekend as Commando started to fade, pulling in $3.2 million to take the weekend, winning its fourth weekend over the debuting Crush Groove, which opened in second at $2.9 million. Jagged Edge was the 14th number one film of 1985. It was only number one for a week. The following week's number one was Death Wish 3. Jagged Edge fell to number three that week, but remained a sleeper hit, continuing to post very small drops. Back to number two in its seventh weekend, remained in the top 10 for 10 weeks, finishing with $40.5 million. It was good for the second 22nd highest grossing film of the year. By the way, and what a perfect occasion when the room is just full of Oscar nerds and no non-Oscar nerds. We should be dropping in Oscar notes in this segment when appropriate.
Yes.
I don't know if it's been appropriate yet.
I'm not sure it has
been. Was Guardians like visual effects? Maybe.
No, who knows?
Jagged Edge was nominated for one Oscar. Robert Loggia was up for Best Supporting Actor. He lost to Don Ameche in Cocoon.
I have so many things to say. Or let me know when you're done and we're going to talk about the Oscars.
Glenn Close was not nominated. This is not one of the eight movies she's been nominated for. Seven movies she's been nominated for without winning. But it did break a three-year nomination streak. Glenn Close was nominated the three previous years for The World According to Garp.
Oh,
no, go ahead.
World According to Garp.
All right.
The Natural and The Big Chill.
Yes.
Okay.
You flipped the time, the years on Big Chill.
Oh, The Natural came out in 84 because that was the number one movie in America when I was born, which incidentally was 35 years ago today.
Happy birthday, Robin.
Yes.
Robin is spending her birthday struggling to speak.
Yes.
About Jagged Edge. Yes. So this broke Glenn Close's, I'm sure she was in the conversation for a nomination.
Yeah, so getting ahead to I did a little bit of research last night. I think that 1985 was an incredibly weak Oscar movie year.
Okay.
Because I basically watching this movie until the last line was baffled that Robert Loggia was nominated for this. He, like, what?
He's just there to, like, give little bits of exposition and swear.
Right. And then I thought about it a little bit more and I was like, I think the swearing was probably a big part of it because this is like a pre-Tarantino world, right?
Yeah.
I think that having someone swear so much in like a mainstream thriller was probably rather shocking.
Particularly an older, distinguished actor type.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that that must have been a big part of it. It's not that meaty of a role and he's not doing anything super special. I was like kind of waiting for him to have a huge scene and he didn't have it.
Kind of a little bit at the end,
but here's the thing, that last line, the last line in the movie, and I'm going to cut it in because it's so great.
Cut.
Fuck him. Name is trash.
It's one of the best line ratings. And I'm someone who regularly tweets like so-and-so should get an Oscar nomination on the basis of this line alone. And that is an example of that. And I'm glad it actually happened once.
That wasn't even my favorite. My favorite was Glenn Close saying, did your mother ever wash your mouth out with soap and water? And Robert Loggia replying, yeah, but it didn't do any fucking good. He was really funny. Oddly, in a like movie with no humor about
it. And then the other thing I wanted to say is that this is 1985 is a year that three of the people who are probably in my top five, yes, they really were nominated for an Oscar, people were nominated. So the other one is in the same category, Eric Roberts.
Yeah, Eric Roberts.
For a movie called Runaway Train, which I didn't know anything about, but I guess it's genuinely about a runaway train.
Sure.
I just looked at the poster and there's a train on it.
It is 7 years. It's from 7 years in the future when they run out of music biopics to do and we're getting down to Soul Asylum.
Yeah. And the other one is, of course, Oprah Winfrey, who's number one. I think a lot of people don't realize that she was an Oscar nominated actress before she was a talk show host.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Before she was a talk show host. And even then, the old uncle from Christmas Vacation was also in this category with Robert Loggia and Eric Roberts.
Who's the old uncle?
I think his name is William Hickey.
Oh, sure. For Prizzi's Honor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who I know as the old uncle in Christmas Vacation, which a role which came 2 years later. So
sure.
That was his Oscar reward.
Yes.
Like, I always have a list of these. I always recognize these when I see them. The, oh, you got nominated for an Oscar, so now you get to be in this Pacific Rim movie.
What?
You know what I mean?
No, I don't know what you mean. Like a character actor who star shines a little bit brighter after their Oscar nomination.
And then they get thrown into something that definitely wouldn't have gone to them beforehand and isn't really appropriate just because now they have name recognition, so they get thrown in whatever. I was specifically thinking of Lupita Nyong'o in Nonstop, the Liam Neeson movie.
Very good.
Which came after 12 Years a Slave.
Okay.
But there's a long list of these. It could be a Tumblr.
Okay. Please do make it happen.
Yeah.
Another person on my short list is Mikhail Baryshnikov.
Mikhail Baryshnikov is an Oscar nominee.
That's correct. He was nominated in 1977 for The Turning Point, which is famous for being the first movie to be nominated for 11 Oscars and be shut out. The second movie to have that sad state of affairs was also in 1985, the movie that Oprah was nominated for, The Color Purple.
The Color Purple didn't win an Oscar.
It did not win one Oscar.
There is so much Oscar talk happening. See what happens when Aaron and Camila show up.
I'm sad they're not here, but then I was like, oh, I'm gonna do a deep dive on some Oscar nerd stuff.
Well, I want to have this conversation, which is purely you and I pulling a Facebook Messenger conversation onto the podcast for no reason. I think maybe the greatest Oscar acceptance speech ever is Joe Pesci's, and you were
strongly
outraged.
Disagree.
And the Oscar goes to Joe Pesci in Goodfellas.
Well, it's my privilege. Thank you.
It's just such a genuine reaction. It's like going up there and going, I don't know how to sum this up. This is great. But
whereas I love the theater, and it's too bad that Camila's not here. Like I say that like my Oscar nerd origin story is Cuba Gooding Jr.'s acceptance speech. One of the greatest moments in live television ever.
That's true. It was great.
Yep. So there's that. I also actually think that this year I watched Don Ameche, his acceptance speech. Really great example of like, wow, they don't make them like they used to, like genuine class.
That was when I realized that I don't know who Don Ameche is and I've never seen Cocoon. Sorry.
Okay. I have a flashbulb memory of Cocoon being on while helping my friend undecorate her Christmas tree.
Yeah.
But I've never actually watched it.
Maybe we'll get to it. I don't think it's a number one.
Anyway, I tried to figure out who should have been nominated in 1985 for Best Supporting Actor, and like, I don't know. I did not go as far as to look up who was nominated for Golden Globes, who wasn't nominated for an Oscar. I should have done that.
That was the dark ages for the Golden Globes, wasn't it? That's not long after.
That's
Pia
like
Zadora.
Pia Zadora. Yeah.
Yeah. How do we Cher presented this Oscar.
And this is a very famous Oscar outfit also, where she has like the feathers in her hair.
I just saw Cher in concert. It was fabulous.
Yeah.
A lot of it was focused on the fact that she has an Oscar.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like,
interesting.
Like, she told, like, right off the bat, she kind of went into a long, rambling monologue. Like, she talked for a good 10 minutes, I think all of which was just to set up admitting that she's 72.
Okay.
Like it was like one of those branching trains of anecdotes that was just to get her back to it. That involved her Oscar. There was later like a clip of, we watched her Oscar acceptance speech in full. At another point in the concert, there was a montage of Cher's movie moments, which included her yelling that Snap she has an Oscar at Frankie Muniz in whatever movie that was.
Oh, dear. I have no idea.
There's one movie where, like, the tiniest background joke is that Frankie Muniz and Cher are having an affair as themselves.
Weird.
And she ended up, you know how she was in Mamma Mia 2 and it was really good? That now translates to three full songs in the Cher show. She does three ABBA songs.
Yikes.
It was great.
Look, she's a national treasure.
Yeah. I like her and I like ABBA.
Have you
ABBA
seen Moonstruck?
No.
It's great and you should watch it.
I took my mom and she was like, have you seen? Oh, you have to see Moonstruck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really good.
I believe it. And I believe she's great in it. Any skepticism I might have once had in Cher was blown away by watching Cher.
Yeah.
What does this have to do with Jagged Edge?
And I have so many things to say about Jagged Edge. So let's get back on track.
I'm almost done with it. It's the 10th highest grossing film of Glenn Close's career. Any guesses?
Tarzan.
No. Guardians of the Galaxy is number one.
Oh, of course. How about 101 Dalmatians was a big hit.
101 Dalmatians is fourth. 102 Dalmatians is fifth. In the middle there were Fatal Attraction and Air Force One is second.
I always forget what a phenomenon Fatal Attraction was. I mean, I was a baby. I don't remember. But that was a huge, huge movie.
It's a whole big thing.
Yeah.
It's the 12th biggest film of Jeff Bridges' career. Both of them, the number one is Marvel. Iron Man is his highest grossing movie. However, Jagged Edge, well ahead of The Big Lebowski in terms of gross. Big Lebowski is one of those movies that just didn't make any money at all.
Mm.
It's less than $19 million is the box office.
I didn't think it would have.
And finally, this is the third highest grossing film for the writer, Joe Esterhaus.
Oh, Joe Esterhaus?
Behind his number one is Basic Instinct.
Of course.
His number two is Flashdance. It's just ahead of Silver. He also wrote Showgirls and Jade. He loves writing movies where grown-ups fuck. That's just his whole jam.
So one thing I got to say is that because when we drew this, we said it was an erotic thriller, right? Because
Wikipedia does.
I really expected more eroticism.
No, it's just a movie.
You see the side of Glenn Close's boob.
It's just a movie where two people over 40, can we say, 37 plus, late 30s, decide to have sex. That's as
Wait
much as
second.
It's an erotic thriller.
I think Glenn Close is like 30 in this.
I don't think so.
Hang on.
Maybe it's just the dignified carriage with which Glenn Close walks through life.
Well, Colin came in while I was watching and he said, oh, she's always had old face.
She kind of has. That's a rough way to put it. I mean, that's not a criticism. She certainly looks lovely in Jagged Edge. And to this day.
She's born in 1947.
So she's 37-ish. That's what I'm saying. We presented this as an erotic thriller because Wikipedia told us it was an
erotic
thriller.
It's really not, though.
It's just that, there's two scenes where they really want to bang and then one scene where they do.
Yep.
That's about it. That said, holy shit, don't have sex with your clients when you're a lawyer.
Yeah, so we're talking about the legal ethics thing. So the main thing is she starts a sexual relationship with her client, which is just incredibly unethical. And it's just, oh my goodness. But then at the same time, she says originally she won't take the case if she thinks he's guilty. And if she decides he's guilty while representing him, that she'll drop him. That's also unethical.
Yeah.
And then later, the judge says something like, do you know that he's guilty? Because she starts to think he's guilty. And she's like, no. And he's like, well, then you don't have an ethical problem. And that's not how this works. You zealously defend your client regardless of your feelings about their guilt. That's not what it's about. Even if they tell you, hey, I did it, then your job is to prove that the state doesn't have a case that they did it.
Robin has a law degree, by the way.
I do.
We failed to set that up.
I do.
Yes.
The only time when your client's guilt becomes an ethical problem for you is if you believe they're going to continue to commit crimes.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have some kind of duty there to not represent them. Listen, it's been 10 years since I was in law school, so, and blah, 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 every state has slightly different ethics rules. But this whole thing of I'll only defend you if you're innocent is nonsense.
No, and I'm not a lawyer, but I did mock trial in high school, and I dated someone while they were studying for the bar. And even at that, I was sitting there throughout the thing going, this is just terrible lawyering.
Right.
There's a dramatic scene. It is more of a courtroom drama. Wikipedia says it's an erotic thriller and a courtroom drama.
It is. I mean, there's a lot of courtroom scenes.
And that's the good stuff of the movie. even as nothing that happens is actually making any sense.
Right.
There's this dramatic scene where the prosecutor, who again...
Peter Coyote, who I love.
He's great. He's also like Glenn Close's old boss and now so rival. Actually, like there's another level
of
this.
Yeah, you had an error in your plot summary. She wasn't a defense attorney. She was a prosecutor.
She was a prosecutor. I'm sorry.
Right. The DA is Peter Coyote. I don't remember the character's name.
Yeah.
And they had a case where they found exonerating evidence and didn't turn it over to the defense. That is unethical.
Yeah.
And the guy got convicted and then killed himself in jail. And she has tremendous guilt over this. Like, and he killed himself in jail, like, just now. So that is... She quit over that, but then she quit over this innocent man going to jail. But then it was him recently having killed himself that is giving her this current ethical crisis, and which may be why she takes Jeff Bridges as a client.
It just felt icky, though. It just felt like really kind of horrible, horrible thing that, you know, should really be the topic of any story, is like gives her a little extra oomph in her motivations.
Well, so I thought at the end when, so little plot details, like I was so focused on the time, I don't remember if you got, did you talk about the typewriter?
No.
Okay, so basically the thing that makes her finally realize that Jeff Bridges is in fact the killer is that she had been getting clues in the mail from a specific typewriter that Robert Loggia figured out which typewriter it was, and that it had an error in the T key. The T was a little offset. And then she's getting, you know, it's a morning afterglow with Jeff Bridges, and he goes off to play with horses or something, rich people do.
Again, the real reason that she accepted him as a client is because he likes horses. You could see in her face her thinking, no one who loves horses can be a killer, and then they're working together. Anyway, right. Go on.
So the horses are foreplay thing is very funny to me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so she finds the typewriter in his closet and, you know, drops the Kobayashi coffee mug or whatever.
Yeah.
Then she goes home. She takes the typewriter as evidence and goes home, which I don't understand why she didn't go to the police.
She went to bed.
Yeah. She's like, let me put this crime evidence that I've wrapped up in a trench coat on my stairs, take a shower and cry.
Yeah.
And then she calls Robert Loggia. This is all so confusing.
She calls Robert Loggia to say something's really wrong. And then clear reason, she's like, no, it's fine.
And then so what I thought was happening there is that she had accepted that he was going to come murder her and that it was like her penance for what happened to Harry Styles or Henry Styles.
What happened to Harry Styles?
What happened to the singer from One Direction?
Yeah.
No. She was like, I thought that it was like suicide by cop, but the cop is a serial killer. she lures him in and shoots him dead. So
but it was too set up. Like, she had the gun and she was waiting. Like,
also, does he really think that he's going to get away? Like, how could he think that that was the right move there?
I'm not defending it, but I think the very, very flimsy justification is blonde tennis douche.
Right.
Which, chef's kiss to the casting. Oh, that is the most blonde tennis douche looking good.
Oh, absolutely.
Tennis douche is what I said.
Yeah.
like, that guy, they say he is now under investigation, but they don't say he has been picked up. So I guess...
See, I guess that if I were in Jeff Bridges' shoes, I would be like, oh, that guy has probably been arrested already, and this is literally going to reveal me as the actual killer.
I think he had to have been assuming that a third murder of the person who, you know, they Tennis Douche and Glenn Close just had a showdown in court. He must have thought, if she gets murdered, it's going to look like him.
Okay.
I guess.
Especially because Peter Coyote had advanced in court that maybe Jeff Bridges... did the original, it wasn't even a murder, it was a maiming.
Yeah.
To throw the cops off the scent.
Guys, if you haven't seen this movie, shit's twisty. Like if you're listening to this having not seen it, and we're throwing in lots of people and plot points that we haven't mentioned to this point, that's because it just kind of keeps going. And I will say, that does make it pretty watchable.
So what did you think watching it? Because I thought he was guilty the whole time.
I thought that he was probably guilty on a bunch of like flimsy conjecture. I thought he was probably guilty mainly because it's always the husband, which is a true crime thing that doesn't necessarily apply to a work of fiction, but like that's just always my assumption. And I don't know if it was deliberate or if it was Jeff Bridges acting, But
he seems like a total creep.
He seems like a creep. I was specifically staring at the scene where he breaks down upon revisiting the crime scene.
Come on.
Where he has this really over the top sobbing with like identifiably no actual tears on his face.
Right. It's good to do, like, it is really hard as an actor to do bad acting.
Right.
You know, kudos to Jeff Bridges.
I want it to be Tennis Douche so that Glenn Close can find love again. But, you know, I thought it was probably him.
Can we talk for a second about her children?
Until you said that, I forgot she had any.
Okay, yeah, so yeah. She's divorced and she has two kids.
Sometimes.
And exactly. how old is the daughter? Because it's like she just stays over at Jeff Bridges' house and then calls in the morning and is like, oh, I'm with a friend.
Yeah, and, I don't know.
Okay, and then the kid.
I guess it was implied that they were with, like, she has a good relationship with her ex and, like, he's around a lot.
Right. Yeah. The younger son is like, oh, I miss my dad, pout. As soon as he showed up on screen, I was like, that guy's someone. I recognized him.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, who is he? And I'm like, I feel my heart wants to say that he's Joey Lawrence, and I know he's not. But
that would be great, though.
But at some point, someone wanted him to be Joey Lawrence. Do you know who it is?
Who is it?
It is, I don't remember the actor's name, but he played JT, the teenage son, on Step by Step, who was a Joey-esque character.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
mm-hmm.
how my brain works.
Not the one that like lived in the van.
No, but the one who was friends with the one who lived
that's
in a van.
That's right.
Yeah. And was a dummy.
Was Step by Step like an awful show
yes.
that we just watched every because day because we were nine?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Poor Patrick Duffy. I don't know why. I just like that. I feel bad for him in my mind for literally no reason. He seems happy. He's a Buddhist. He made a lot of money.
Oh, good
but when
for
I
him.
Think of Patrick Duffy, I'm like, oh, poor guy.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Going back to the whole, what did you think? I thought that Jeff Bridges did it mostly for extra textual reasons. The first being, I was like, why would this movie even exist without that being the answer?
Right.
And then the second was when I Googled it, it said people also Googled Primal Fear.
Ah, sure.
And I was like, okay. So that sort of primed me to think like, oh, he did it.
Yeah, it's...
Do you know what Roger Ebert said?
What did Roger Ebert say?
Roger Ebert gave this 3.5 stars and he has a 4-star system. So mm-hmm. the only proper system. Sorry. No, 1 to 10 is also fine. But the whole 5-star thing drives me nuts. That's not the right number of stars.
But 5 stars is a 1 to 10.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
But movies go up to 4 stars.
Okay.
Yeah.
I admit that everyone should agree because then you're like 4 stars and you're like, why didn't you give it 5?
Right.
Because I only give 4.
Right.
Oh. Hmm. Yeah.
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 And also, like, Roger Ebert used a 4-star scale, so he's the boss of us.
Right.
Us
right.
being people who care about movies.
Right.
So fully anyway, agreed. He said he was, like, you know, he was in praise of the twists and turns, and he said, like, he changed his mind several times over the course of the movie if he thought that Jeff Bridges did it or not, which I think is really cool. I think that that's the right mindset to be in watching this kind of movie.
Mm-hmm.
When she murders him, he has a mask on, and then she pulls off the mask, and he thought that they should have not pulled off the mask, and so that you don't know.
And he was happy that that Inception ended before the top fell down or not?
Yes.
I am totally cool with ambiguous endings.
I would have felt like that was a cheat. I just thought it was interesting to bring up.
It's interesting that he wanted that. There's lots of times when I'm totally fine with that. Not in this pulpy movie of the week stuff.
Right.
Not here. Like, I'm diminishing it a little bit, but fundamentally we have, like, a mystery, an airport mystery novel
right.
of a movie. Yeah, we need to know the ending.
So one thing I wanted to say is that this kind of movie is like exactly why I was excited when you came up with this premise for the podcast.
I agree.
Because it's like, I would never have watched this movie ever.
Mm-hmm.
And it was perfectly interesting and diverting. And I don't think I had even heard of it. Oh, I guess I kind of recognized it because I knew that Robert Loggia was nominated for it.
Right, right.
But yeah, it's really... It's a cool thing to revisit something that was seen by enough people that it was the number one movie in America
mm-hmm.
and got 3.5 stars from Roger Ebert and an Oscar nomination, but has completely, you know, fallen by the wayside.
You wouldn't even find this on like a DVD box set of 80s thrillers.
Right.
Like this wouldn't make that cut.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, totally enjoyable.
I don't know if I think it was a good movie or not.
I don't think it is a good movie. My score for it isn't super high, but it's not bad. Let's put it that way.
No.
I definitely was entertained by it.
Yeah, I think it's the thing that I like about it the most is not really to its credit as a work. It's just that we've said this before. There aren't really movies like this anymore.
Right.
There aren't movies that are, you know, again, a story about people who are 40 or older, and it has a love subplot and sex scenes, and it's a purely adult thing that has no bearing whatsoever on children, but at the same time isn't, except for the opening scene, isn't like
super tawdry and gross.
Super tawdry and gross. And it, you know, it starts and we get right into the movie and like learn who the characters are through acting and circumstances.
Right.
Like it's a pace that's gone and it's a style of movie that's gone. And I like that a lot. I don't know if it makes that a good movie, but it was very pleasant to watch.
Yeah. So I don't know if we named our 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon segment.
Oh, yeah. How do we connect this to The Sum of All Fears?
Okay. Mm-hmm. I can do it in two and in an embarrassing way. So
okay.
Glenn Close to Christian Slater in The Wife.
Ah.
And then Christian Slater mm-hmm. to Morgan Freeman in Hard Rain.
Ooh.
Which is another, this movie is not good,
mm-hmm.
but sure will entertain you for 2 hours.
How do you think The Wife's going to age? Completely forgotten? Now that she didn't win for it?
So, right. I am not sure. How is The Mirror Has Two Faces aged?
Yeah,
you know, like, yeah. I don't have any memory of that movie. I think that, but I remember what it's called because it was a shocking loss.
Yeah.
For non-Oscar nerds, Lauren Bacall was nominated for this Barbra Streisand movie, The Mirror Has Two Faces. Everyone thought she was going to win Best Supporting Actress. Juliette Binoche won for The English Patient and literally said in her acceptance speech, I thought Lauren was going to win.
Yeah.
I think Juliette Binoche calling Lauren Bacall Lauren like they're super familiar is a little weird.
Isn't it nice when someone or like when someone says Tony Perkins? Just like, aw, you talk about each other like your people.
Bobby De Niro.
That, yeah. I want for the rest of time more like Instagram videos of the Avengers hanging out. Yeah. Did you see the one yesterday where like Robert Downey Jr. paid for tacos and a mariachi band on Cinco de Mayo as they were filming?
No.
And it's like Nebula in full makeup sitting calmly eating nachos while a mariachi band plays nearby. These are all great.
Yes.
Anyway, what's the point?
Juliette Binoche probably wasn't buddy-buddy with Lauren Bacall.
Probably not.
Yeah.
No. or Lady Gaga and Glenn Close,
right.
But they looked so friendly when they were together.
But anyway, we remember the name of that movie, so I think people will remember the name of The Wife because it was so shocking that Glenn Close did not win.
Yeah.
But I don't think they'll remember the movie. Also, it's not that good a movie.
The Wife?
Yeah.
I liked it a bunch, but that was mostly on the performance.
But it was an amazing performance.
I think it does the process of receiving a Pulitzer count as a slice of life. It is an interesting setting.
It's a Nobel.
It was a Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
But like the thing where they sing to you in the middle of the night and going over and talking to the people who are here to help you get a Nobel
Prize. That was genuinely interesting. The part where they instruct him how to bow.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That was, no one saw The Wife.
And also, Christian Slater was pretty good.
Yeah,
in
he was good.
Yeah.
It's weird. I mean, now we're still on, again, Camila and Aaron leave, and we're like, let's dissect the 2019 Oscars even more. I am amused by Olivia Colman winning. I am genuinely glad that The Favorite, a movie that I loved, won one Oscar.
Yes.
As I get farther away from it, I'm pissed about that. She was very good. That's not, it wasn't a leading role.
I think she was amazing. That was a supporting role. And also, if she were in the proper category, she should have lost to Regina King. So.
Yeah. She was amazing. I don't think she was as good as either Glenn Close or Lady Gaga.
Yeah. I think you and I have different feelings about Lady Gaga's Oscar worthiness than normal people.
Yeah.
But she still won an Oscar, so.
Yeah, she got an Oscar that night.
She just needs a Tony now.
And she has a Critics' Choice Awards, thanks to me.
Yeah.
Let's rate Jagged Edge, which is available everywhere. Just watch it. It's on YouTube and Google Play. It's on all the places. There's just two of us. I guess a 60. Wait, you said wait as I was saying the number.
I thought that we were going to talk about how great I am at getting the right number.
I'm going to save it for next episode.
Okay.
Since there's only two of us here. So inevitably.
My number is 62.
All right. There we go. I don't even have to use a calculator. We both gave it 60s. The score is 60.
No, I'm sorry. My number is 62.
Oh, 62.
Yes.
Okay. I can still do that one in my head. The average is 61. No, Robin almost always, we'll go over this when we're all here. Robin almost always nails the average score of the whole room, as happened again today. 60 to me is like just the bare, like, this is good, and that's the end of the sentence.
You know,
this is not bad. It's above average if you took every movie that was ever made. But that's all I can really say about it. It is time for You Can't Handle the Truth, where we talk about things. I think we just have to talk about Endgame.
Yeah.
And I've seen a bunch of movies. Let's both briefly acknowledge that we both saw and loved Her Smell with Elizabeth
Moss. Her Smell is so good. It's probably gone from theaters by the time we drop this episode.
Yeah.
Please watch for it to hit streaming and other video on demand things. It's so, so, so good.
It would be, it's right now, it's my number two movie of the year, exactly one spot ahead of Endgame. So,
yeah, what's your number one so far?
Us almost by default.
Okay. Yeah, I think,
yeah, like that won't hold up.
Yeah,
but
I think it's so far my favorite of the year.
Yeah, and Elizabeth Moss is fantastic.
Yeah,
again, she'll be number two when I vote for Best Actress because of Lupita Nyong'o.
But I can't decide yet. It's sort of how I felt about Glenn Close and Lady Gaga.
Those are four very similar performances in nearly identical films. Her Smell is great. And I've seen 10 things in the last 2 weeks. But let's talk about Endgame. First, this is a box office podcast.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
This
it broke the mold.
Obliterated like everything that should have been possible.
Yeah. Because I read an article about a week before it came out that was like going through why it is literally impossible for it to make $300 million, and it made $350
million. $357 million.
Right, exactly.
I have to check the numbers today. There's a question over whether or not it will also have the number, the biggest second weekend ever. But the previous record for a weekend was right around 250, like 251.
And the previous record was Infinity
War. And this beat it by over $100 million.
Well, I think a couple of things happened there. So first of all, I saw it at 7 a.m.
Yeah.
Like the fact that they're showing a movie at 7 a.m. is unprecedented in this country.
That's the first time I've heard of this, where some theaters said we are not closing between Thursday and Sunday night.
Right.
And I hadn't heard of this either. Theaters were frantically adding showings.
Right. The 7 a.m. showing that I saw did not exist at the beginning of the week. Mm-hmm. And I was very upset because I was like, when am I going to see it? The second thing is, I think that because Infinity War had such a surprising ending to a lot of people, I'm sure many, many people saw it after knowing how it ends and were kind of like, I wish I didn't know how it ended. I think that there was this urge to see it the first weekend.
They combined two things, I think. It's Infinity War had all of the hype of, you know, 20, whatever it was then, 18 movies have led up to this movie.
Right.
And then they somehow made Endgame have that same amount of hype, plus this is part two of a thing that ended on a cliffhanger.
Right.
And we're kind of at peak, oh my God, no spoilers, which has become a deafening cry of the culture and is, you know, reached its absolute apex this spring between Game of Thrones and Avengers.
Yes.
So I think people were absolutely desperate to have that pure viewing.
Well, that's how I felt.
Yeah.
For sure.
We're willing to go see it
in
the first 3 weeks at any cost, to the point where I look at these numbers way too closely. And for 3 days, it obliterated every record you could possibly conceive of. And then it doesn't have the biggest opening Monday of all time. It doesn't have the biggest opening Tuesday of all time. Like, it couldn't break those, like, immediately after the first weekend records, because more people than ever before needed to see this immediately.
Right. So do you think it's going to ultimately pass Avatar?
No, I think it'll be second.
Okay.
I think it will. I will immediately correct myself. I do think it'll pass Avatar and will become the biggest global total of all time.
That's what I was asking.
I don't think it will become the domestic number one of all time.
Isn't the domestic number one Force Awakens?
It's Force Awakens.
Okay.
And Force Awakens was much more of a... it was another case where everyone, a ton of people saw it the opening weekend with all of this hype behind it. But then
they go see it multiple times.
They went and saw it multiple times. And the fact that people generally thought it was very good got more people interested in it who didn't care that first weekend.
Oh.
It transitioned from every Star Wars fan ever to just everybody ever. You know, like
really? I wouldn't have thought that.
I think a lot of people who don't care about Star Wars heard how great it was, and in the second, third, fourth, fifth weekend went to see it.
People who don't care about Marvel are like, I'm not going to watch 20 movies.
Right.
Although I made a list, so we went out on Friday with some of Colin's coworkers, and a couple of them were like, I'm going with my boyfriend. What movies do I absolutely have to watch? And I made a list. I like kind of ranked them in order of importance.
Like the bare minimum answer is like
Infinity War. That's what I said.
And especially if it's Avengers 1 and Infinity War.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you can go.
Yeah.
And you'd still enjoy it. But I think that a lot of people aren't going to if it's just that. Like, I know people who have seen like Black Panther and Guardians 1. That's not like, oh, yeah, you can go see Endgame.
I mean, you can, but I think that Infinity War will help a lot because it's like part two.
Right.
I mean, they originally were going to call it Infinity War part two.
Right, right.
I do think the other thing, that 3 hour runtime, you know, Titanic was 3 hours, 15 minutes.
Yeah.
But I know that I'm a huge dork and I want to see it again. And I just haven't been able to set aside 3.5 hours to go see it.
It could certainly become the biggest movie in every conceivable ranking. The important thing is, for me, for someone who loves movies and loves movie theaters, it was just really exciting to see like movie theaters become this hive of passionate activity
Being
for 4 days.
In a full movie theater at 7 a.m. was thrilling for me.
Yeah.
Because I go to the movies on Friday mornings all the time because I don't go to my day job on Fridays. Mm-hmm. So it's like whatever's playing at 11 a.m. on Friday. I think I probably talked about this on the podcast before.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's normally a ghost town. And even at more prime times, theaters are often a ghost town, and it makes me sad because I love the movie theater experience. Mm-hmm. So this was very cool.
I backed into something I really enjoyed because there's an industry ride or at least, you know, in certain cities there has been a decline in sneak previews in recent years, and mm-hmm. this year particularly. And Endgame didn't have a sneak preview that critics could go to in Pittsburgh. And initially I was very upset about that.
Right.
But what happened was they said, here's Fandango money. You're on the radio and the internet.
Right.
You don't have to meet a deadline. Go Thursday night.
How did they deal with the fact that like all the theaters were sold out?
Oh, that was on me to figure out.
Okay.
And like the first six I tried, I couldn't manage. But I think I caught the first wave of more screens were
adding
being
more
added.
Screens. Got it.
And so I got like a 3D, not IMAX, you know, like mm-hmm. a good but not great showing, and just got there an hour and a half early so I could get a decent seat. But anyway, it went from, you know, if it had been the way it used to be, I probably would have seen it on a Tuesday afternoon in a mostly empty theater with people taking notes.
Right.
And instead, I saw it with people losing their damn minds.
Right.
Which was really, really cool. And it was, you know what was nice about this one is this wasn't like an opening night where all of the Marvel fans are cheering when the logo comes up and are like...
Because it's coming in so sad.
Yeah, because it starts with this downer moment, and because I think everyone was sitting there like, what's going to happen?
Right, right, right.
So there were when Captain America said Hail Hydra, the crowd went nuts, mm-hmm. and especially when he picked up the hammer, like
so
people
great.
Lose. Wait, Endgame spoilers? It's the biggest movie of all time. You've seen it. But they eventually went nuts. But for the first hour and a half, people were just biting their nails and hoping for the best.
Yeah.
And what we haven't talked about yet, it's pretty good.
Yeah. I thought it was incredibly satisfying, which is, that's really what I wanted from it. I don't really care how good of a movie it is.
Yeah.
I wanted to be satisfied, and I was.
It was a fantastic spectacle, and it was a good way to end the longest continuous movie series of all time.
Yeah.
Like, it was a satisfying ending. If I sat and nitpicked, you know.
I have complaints.
They didn't earn any of that Hawkeye shit.
Yeah, come on.
Like, you did, I guess, some of the Hawkeye, like, the opening Hawkeye scene was good, but, like, You insisting that Hawkeye is important now doesn't make me suddenly care about him after 20 False. Movies. That's the nitpick. Other than that...
I thought some of the fat Thor stuff was kind of like, come on, guys. It's like poking fun at him for being fat. I'm like, this is stupid.
They made fun of him more than they should have.
Yeah.
I liked it in general, and I think I saw on Reddit, which is not always where you go for great takes, someone made the argument, this spoke to me because this was a very accurate on-screen depiction of depression.
Yeah.
Where a guy is just like not giving a shit as his life falls apart.
Right.
But he's like, we're having a good time. Have a beer. We're playing video games. Hang out. I'm not worried about it. No, I'm good, man.
Right.
Like that was, that is an interesting way to have gone with it. And I enjoyed it.
My favorite moment in the whole movie after the, like, look at the ladies. Was when the lightning braids his beard. What a ridiculous thing.
Oh, he's so great.
I giggled for a solid minute.
I really loved Nebula in it. I really loved Captain Marvel in it. And the crazy thing is, it was so satisfying and it still left me excited for the what Thor is going to be in Guardians 3.
Remember how when we did Guardians 2 I was like, I don't care about Guardians 3. Well, apparently what it takes is adding Thor. I also am glad Gamora's back in the mix.
Yeah, and that's like, that gave me the biggest pause afterwards. I was like, why wasn't Gamora, where do they meet? Why isn't Gamora with them? And Mary Beth was like, she doesn't know them.
Yeah.
She has no relationship with them. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
I think Loki might have a Tesseract in another reality.
Yeah.
That's
apparently going to be a Disney Plus TV show.
They set up a lot that I care about while also concluding everything.
Right. It's a very weird thing to end a story that isn't actually over, but like it really does genuinely feel like an end.
And did you watch the Spider-Man trailer dropped yesterday?
I did not.
It looks real good, and it looks real good, and what blew my mind is that it's 2 weeks after Endgame, and I'm like, I can't wait for that next Marvel movie.
Exactly, right.
You know?
Yeah.
They know what they're doing.
They know what they're doing. Colin says that all the time. He goes, they know how to make movies.
They absolutely do. They're very good at filmmaking. Let's draw a movie and go home. Let's see. And again, we're in a unique position right now, because just me and Robin are here, and I used my veto. So only Robin could all of the power is in Robin's hand. The number is 736, and that is, we are actually going even earlier in time to watch Oh God, You Devil.
Excellent.
Does that have George Burns?
Sure.
What? Tell me about Oh God, You Devil.
It's the sequel to Oh God. where George Burns plays God.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is it like a spoof? Is it no,
it's a comedy.
It's the third in the series after Oh God and Oh God Book 2. Okay. If Aaron were here, he would be overjoyed and furious that I haven't already seen it, I'm sure.
I feel like this is probably not a super important part of the canon.
I feel like this is going to be like, yes, that was funny.
Yeah. George Burns is a treasure.
Holy crap, does this not hold up well in 2019? Yeah, is my prediction.
I mean, I may have seen this movie. It'll be interesting if it like unlocks memories for me, because I know I've seen Oh God and I don't remember anything about it. So
I feel like it was on Comedy Central a lot when Comedy Central began.
Yeah, exactly.
But I might be thinking of The Gods Must Be Crazy.
Oh, that movie's awesome.
I haven't seen that one either. Okay. Is that should I have seen that?
I mean, again, it also doesn't really hold up.
It's not. It's no Cocoon, I'll tell you.
Also, you know, before Neil Blomkamp was the highest grossing South African film.
Ah.
So.
I also don't know the difference between Cocoon and Splash, and I feel like they're very different
things. They are so different.
A mermaid could come out of a cocoon. Is Cocoon not at all... what's Cocoon?
Cocoon is about... And again, I haven't seen it,
yeah.
But it is about, I think, eternal life. It's for old people.
It's not about a butterfly lady.
It's like old people who are able to stay alive.
I think that's what it's about. Because Splash is about someone falling in love with a mermaid.
That's correct.
In my mind, that meant that Cocoon was about someone falling in love with a butterfly lady.
Not the case at all.
Yeah. What was the number one song in America?
Well, so you said it was close to Invasion USA, so my guess is going to be Money for Nothing stuck around.
Money for Nothing didn't stick around for that long.
Okay.
Money for Nothing had 3 weeks, and then there were a bunch of 1 week 1 week hits. So.
And this is one of them?
This is one of them.
Okay, well, 1 week hits of 1985, I'm definitely going to need a clue.
The singer is no longer with us.
Okay, is it a George Michael?
No, but
Prince.
No. Yeah, that doesn't narrow it down.
No.
This female singer is no longer with us.
I'm going to need more than that.
I know. There also needs to be more than one person in the room to crowdsource figuring this out. This female singer, who was the subject of a fairly well-received but biased documentary in the recent past, is no longer with us. It was like the...
Oh, Whitney Houston.
It's Whitney Houston with... It's not one of the ones you'd remember.
Okay.
It's Whitney Houston's Saving All My Love for You.
Oh, yeah, I don't remember that.
St. Elmo's Fire theme for 2 weeks, then Money for Nothing for 3 weeks, then Oh Sheila by Ready for the World. No idea what that was.
Oh, Sheila. Bum, 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 bum.
That didn't help.
Okay.
Then Take on Me for 1 week. Take on Me was only 1 week on the top.
Mm.
Then Saving All My Love for You by Whitney Houston, which only stayed for 1 week before Part-Time Lover by Stevie Wonder. It was a year. God, I love the St. Elmo's Fire theme. And I've never seen St. Elmo's Fire.
I don't think it has anything to do with the film. Abby Feuder, our dear friend and fan of the podcast, thank you, Abby, for listening, has a joke about that, which is you can literally put the title of any movie in the chorus.
Oh, God, you devil.
Exactly.
Oh, jagged edge. Yes, that's true. We'll be back soon to talk about Oh God, You Devil, and I will learn things about George Burns. I know he's an old man and they sold joke books. That's all that I know. I will learn more things next time. Happy birthday, Robin.
Thanks.
Number one movie in America.